Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 8, Chapter 8. That evening, the Rostovs went to the opera, for which Maya Dmitrievna had taken a box. Natasha did not want to go, but could not refuse Maya Dmitrievna's kind offer, which was intended expressly for her. When she came, ready dressed, into the ballroom to await her father, and looking in the large mirror, there saw that she was pretty, very pretty. She felt even more sad, but it was a sweet, tender sadness. Oh God, if he were here now, I would not behave as I did then, but differently. I would not be silly and afraid of things. I would simply embrace him, cling to him, and make him look at me with those searching, inquiring eyes with which he has so often looked at me, and then I would make him laugh as he used to laugh. And his eyes. How I see those eyes, thought Natasha. And what do his father and sister matter to me? I love him alone, him. Him with that face and those eyes, with his smile, manly and yet childlike. No, I had better not think of him. Not think of him, but forget him. Quite forget him, for the present. I can't bear this waiting, and I shall cry in a minute. And she turned away from the glass, making an effort not to cry. And how can Sonya love Nicholas so calmly and quietly, and wait so long and so patiently? Thought she, looking at Sonya, who also came in quite ready, with a fan in her hand. No, she's altogether different. I can't. Natasha at that moment felt so softened and tender that it was not enough for her to love and know she was beloved. She wanted now, at once, to embrace the man she loved, to speak and hear from him words of love such as filled her heart. While she sat in the carriage beside her father, pensively watching the light of the street lamps flickering on the frozen window, she felt still sadder and more in love, and forgot where she was going and with whom. Having fallen into the line of carriages, the Rostovs' carriage drove up to the theatre, its wheels squeaking over the snow. Natasha and Sonya, holding up their dresses, jumped out quickly. The Count got out, helped by the footman, and passing among men and women who were entering, and the program sellers, they all three went along the corridor to the first row of boxes. Through the closed doors the music was already audible. "Natasha, your hair!" whispered Sonya. An attendant, deferentially and quickly, slipped before the ladies and opened the door of their box. The music sounded louder, and through the door rows of brightly lit boxes in which ladies sat with bare arms and shoulders and noisy stalls brilliant with uniforms glittered before their eyes. A lady entering the next box shot a glance of feminine envy at Natasha. The curtain had not yet risen and the overture was being played. Natasha, smoothing her gown, went in with Sonya and sat down, scanning the brilliant tiers of boxes opposite. A sensation she had not experienced for a long time, that of hundreds of eyes looking at her bare arms and necks, suddenly affected her both agreeably and disagreeably, and called up a whole crowd of memories, desires, and emotions associated with that feeling. The two remarkably pretty girls, Natasha and Sonya, with Count Rostov, who had not been seen in Moscow for a long time, attracted general attention. Moreover, everybody knew vaguely of Natasha's engagement to Prince Andrew and knew that the Rostovs had lived in the country ever since, and all looked with curiosity at a fiancé who was making one of the best matches in Russia. Natasha's looks, as everyone told her, had improved in the country, and that evening, thanks to her agitation, she was particularly pretty. She struck those who saw her by her fullness of life and beauty, combined with her indifference to everything about her. Her black eyes looked at the crowd without seeking anyone, and her delicate arm, bare to above the elbow, lay on the velvet edge of the box, while, evidently, unconsciously, she opened and closed her hand in time to the music, crumpling her program. "Look, there's Alanina," said Sonya. "With her mother, isn't it?" "Dear me, Michael Kirillovich has grown still stouter," remarked the Count. "Look at our Anna Mikhailovna. What a headdress she has on. The Karagins, Julie and Boris with them. One can see at once that they're engaged." "Drubetskoy has proposed." "Oh yes, I heard it today," said Shinshin, coming into the Rostov's box. Natasha looked in the direction in which her father's eyes were turned and saw Julie sitting beside her mother with a happy look on her face and a string of pearls round her thick red neck, which Natasha knew was covered with powder. Behind them, wearing a smile and leaning over with an ear to Julie's mouth, was Boris's handsome, smoothly brushed head. He looked at the Rostovs from under his brows and said something, smiling to his betrothed. "They are talking about us, about me and him," thought Natasha, "and he no doubt is calming her jealousy of me. They needn't trouble themselves, if only they knew how little I am concerned about any of them." Behind them sat Anna Mikhailovna, wearing a green headdress and with a happy look of resignation to the will of God on her face. Their box was pervaded by that atmosphere of an affianced couple which Natasha knew so well and liked so much. She turned away and suddenly remembered all that had been humiliating in her morning's visit. "What right has he not to wish to receive me into his family? Oh, better not think of it. Not till he comes back," she told herself, and began looking at the faces, some strange and some familiar, in the stalls. In the front, in the very centre, leaning back against the orchestra rail, stood Dolokhov in a Persian dress, his curly hair brushed up into a huge shock. He stood in full view of the audience, well aware that he was attracting everyone's attention, yet as much at ease as though he were in his own room. Around him thronged Moscow's most brilliant young men, whom he evidently dominated. The Count, laughing, nudged the blushing Sonya, and pointed to her former adorer. "Do you recognize him?" said he. "And where has he sprung from?" he asked, turning to Shinshin. "Didn't he vanish somewhere?" "He did," replied Shinshin. "He was in the Caucasus and ran away from there. They say he has been acting as minister to some ruling prince in Persia, where he killed the Shah's brother. Now all the Moscow ladies are mad about him. It's Dolokhov the Persian, that does it. We never hear a word, but Dolokhov is mentioned. They swear by him, they offer him to you as they would a dish of choice sterlet. Dolokhov and Anatole Kurigin have turned all our ladies' heads." A tall, beautiful woman with a mass of plaited hair and much exposed plump white shoulders and neck, round which she wore a double string of large pearls, entered the adjoining box rustling her heavy silk dress and took a long time settling into her place. Natasha involuntarily gazed at that neck, those shoulders and pearls and coiffure, and admired the beauty of the shoulders and the pearls. While Natasha was fixing her gaze on her for the second time, the lady looked round and, meeting the Count's eyes, nodded to him and smiled. She was the Countess Bezukhova, Pierre's wife, and the Count, who knew everyone in society, leaned over and spoke to her. "Have you been here long, Countess?" he inquired. I'll call to kiss your hand. I'm here on business and have brought my girls with me. They say Semenova acts marvellously. Count Pierre never used to forget us. Is he here?" "Yes, he meant to look in," answered Helena, and glanced attentively at Natasha. Count Rostov resumed his seat. "Handsome, isn't she?" he whispered to Natasha. "Wonderful," answered Natasha. "She's a woman one could easily fall in love with." Just then the last chords of the overture were heard, and the conductor tapped with his stick. Some late comers took their seats in the stalls and the curtain rose. As soon as it rose, everyone in the boxes and stalls became silent, and all the men, old and young, in uniform and evening dress, and all the women with gems on their bare flesh, turned their whole attention with eager curiosity to the stage. Natasha, too, began to look at it. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, and the gang has gone to the opera. And as Brian E. Denton said in his Medium post about this chapter, it seems like this chapter, and according to Brian, the next few chapters, would be very good in a movie. They're very cinematic chapters. He said they would have the base elements of powerful filmmaking, dazzling visuals, oral delights, and a dramatic storyline featuring compelling, conflicted characters. Who Was Once Delight said, this chapter focuses on Natasha's point of view. How do you think Sonia's impressions of the opera and the society gathered there would differ from her cousin's? How do you think she would feel about seeing Dolokhov again? What about Boris and Julie? Sonia, as far as I'm concerned, is kind of a bit of a closed book. We don't get much insight into Sonia's head, certainly not as much as Natasha. B52 girl said, Sonia is typical Sonia, just happy to be part of things and by Natasha's side. She probably feels fortunate that she's able to experience the opera, parties, and all that Russian society has to offer her as dowerless Sonia. You know, it was funny, I think the chapter where we really got an insight to Sonia was, funnily enough, the one where she was in disguise and she had the cork mustache and everything on. It was on the Christmas festivities. And in that chapter, in disguise, she was actually quite charismatic and outgoing and confident. Something I think is a little bit suppressed by Natasha, who she loves Natasha, but Natasha is always the center of every room she's in. She's always the one that grabs the most attention. Who Was Once Delight also asked, what is it about Natasha that captures Helena's attention, and what do you think Natasha admires in Helena? How do you think these two would get along if they met? Well, I would love for them to meet, and I've got a feeling they will. Helena is beautiful and confident and successful, and she's married to a successful person, one of the wealthiest people in the country, and I think that's what captures Natasha's attention, and that's why Natasha admires her. She's just so beautiful. B52 girl said, Tolstoy is setting us up for some Helena-Natasha competition. I can feel it. The way they sized each other up, Helena's attentive gaze focused on Natasha, Natasha admiring the beauty of Helena's shoulders and pearls compared to the fat, red, powdered neck of the nearly spinstered Julie. Oh, this is going to be good. Popcorn emoji. Good use of the popcorn emoji, B52 girl. I hope you're right, actually. I hadn't thought of Helena and Natasha competing, but they might be competing. And I don't think it'll be a love triangle thing, because that would mean it'll be Helena and Natasha competing for Pierre's attention, which could happen. I suppose that could happen. But I think Natasha is pretty set on Prince Andrei. If there was going to be some kind of thing between Natasha and Pierre, a love triangle, well, that would be a love square, because you'd have Helena, Natasha, Pierre, and Prince Andrei in this weird dynamic of who's going to do what. That could get messy. That could get quite ugly. You know, it did strike me this chapter. Brian said about how cinematic this chapter could have been, and I do agree with that, but it did strike me that it didn't have much detail in the setting. I didn't feel like I was there. I couldn't picture the room, other than the fact that I've been in old theatres where opera and that kind of thing would take place, not in Russia, and certainly not that old, but I've got some idea from old theatres I've been in around Melbourne and around Australia. But it just seemed like a missed opportunity because, well, first of all, most people in Russia, even back in the 1800s, probably hadn't been to the opera. I think you had to be part of high society to go to the opera theatre. I might have that wrong, but I suspect that's the case. Which would mean if you can put them in the scene and make them feel like they're really there, people might be fascinated to do that. People love to read and be immersed in a scene that they might not otherwise be able to be immersed in. So Tolstoy must have known that not everyone who was going to read his book would be part of the same high society that he was. And I'm sure he was also, on some level, aware that the book would last for many years, that people many years down the line would read his book. And so it's a good opportunity to, over the ages, explain to someone like me here in 2018 what it was like to be at an opera in Russia in the early 1800s. I was disappointed that the scene really wasn't painted. I can't picture the venue that well. It's mostly just my own imagination of what I think it would look like, but we didn't really get much given to us. Certainly Tolstoy puts a lot more effort into describing a forest or anything in nature than he does a building. And lastly, I'll just talk about Natasha. That feeling that I got from her this chapter was pretty familiar. You know, when you're just pining over someone or there's something on your mind that you just can't get off your mind and you think, oh, I'll go out to this social event. I've got to go to this thing, make an appearance, and it might take my mind off it. But then you're just so distant while you're at that thing that you just can't stop thinking about the thing that's on your mind, even if you are at a spectacular event of some kind and there's people everywhere and there's attention turned towards you and people are whispering about you and gossiping. Natasha's attention is kind of jumping all over the place and she's not very focused on what's going on around her. Everything grabs her attention momentarily, but it's torn this way and that. Brian E. Denton used the word scatterbrained, but it keeps going back to Prince Andrei. That's the thing that's making her attention so weak. She can't focus on anything because she just keeps going back to thinking about Prince Andrei over and over. And Tolstoy did do a really good job of conveying that feeling in this chapter. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to leave the episode there. Thanks very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow. And do check out the Patreon page. I've been completely forgetting to mention the Patreon page. But if you want to support the podcast with $1 a month, $5 a month, $30 a month, whatever you choose, you can go ahead to the Patreon page. It's patreon.com/AYEAROFWARANDPEACEPODCAST. There's a link in the description to this episode. Any help you want to contribute would be very much appreciated on my end. Thanks again for listening. See you tomorrow.